Good morning and welcome to the Public Safety Committee of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. My name is Supervisor John Avalos, the chair of the committee, joined to my right by the vice chair, Supervisor Cristina Olague, and to my left by Supervisor Eric Marr. The clerk today is Erica Dayrick. Madam Clerk, could you share with us your announcements?
Yes, please make sure to silence all cell phones and electronic devices. Completed speaker cards and copies of any documents to be included as part of the file should be submitted to the clerk. Items acted upon today will appear on the December 4th Board of Supervisors agenda unless otherwise stated.
Thank you. I also want to recognize the SFGTV staff who are working on this committee hearing, Nona Melkonian and Bill Dillon. Madam Clerk, could you please call item number one?
Item number one, resolution urging the Metropolitan Transportation Commission of the state legislature to strengthen the privacy provisions of personal information of the Clipper Card program.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. This is an item that I have called forward, and I want to thank my co-sponsors, Supervisor Chu and Supervisor Olague, my committee members, for their co-sponsorship. This resolution has come out of recent media reports that have raised concerns about the Clipper Card privacy policy. And after reviewing this issue further and discussing it with the staff from the MTC, I am encouraged that they want to make the Clipper Card possible as privacy policy as strong as possible. The Clipper Card privacy policy gives the MTC the right to maintain all personal information indefinitely for active Clipper accounts and for up to 7 years after accounts are closed or terminated. I'm encouraged that the MTC is taking steps to address these issues on their own. It is my hope that this resolution can reassure Clipper users that the MTC is protecting their right to privacy. The Clipper privacy policy is more restrictive than the privacy policies for cell phone plans, which often allow cell phone companies to sell our personal information. I'm glad to hear that's not the case with the Clipper card. Most of us are now carrying around smartphones, which are far more effective at tracking our every move than Clipper cards. A recently designed smartphone application provides the ability to scan any Clipper card and obtain the card's stored transit usage history. This smartphone application can potentially be used without the Clipper card owner's permission or knowledge simply by placing the smartphone near someone else's Clipper card. This public availability of Clipper card users' transit history creates a potential public safety risk by exposing BART users' regular travel patterns. People can protect themselves from this by storing their Clipper cards in a bag or somewhere where it would be difficult for someone else to place a smartphone within a few inches of the card, thus perhaps getting that information. The resolution addresses this issue. What the resolution, and I have an amendment of the whole that I passed on to the clerk, and it actually includes amendments that have been proposed by the MTC. We definitely wanted to work with the MTC on their concerns about moving forward with the new resolution. And so the new resolution reflects those proposed amendments, and they include a way to determine what the minimum duration of time is that, excuse me, I'm reading this for the first time. It will request that the MTC provide a minimum duration of time that they will maintain Clipper users' transit history and personal information and to revise their privacy policy in time. The MTC agrees that they shouldn't need to keep this information for 7 years after the account is closed, and they'll be reducing that amount of time in the future, and they've agreed to do that. They will also explore the feasibility of minimizing the data stored on Clipper cards, encrypting the data, or providing the ability for users to clear the data. They also will agree, and the resolution requests that the MTC provide FAQs, frequently asked questions, and information regarding those questions on a website that Clipper card users could actually access that will explain the privacy policy on how the Clipper cards are used. It also create an annual transparency report that publishes the number of requests for information from law enforcement and other groups and the percentage of those requests that actually were granted. So that would also be information that will be shared with other agencies and with the public, so that if law enforcement agencies want to gather information, that will be shared the number of times it happened over the course of a year. The amendment of the whole removes the resolve clauses that ask the state legislature to legislate privacy requirements for Clipper. And that was something that was a big concern for the MTC, so we removed that language and really feel that the MTC has been working well with us with other stakeholders to assure that there are actual new plans in place for how the privacy policy will be implemented. And I want to thank the MTC, in particular Randy Rentschler, who's here, for your work and with our office on that. Thank you. So colleagues, if you have, if there are comments or questions, I had originally, thought that this resolution could go for adoption without committee reference, but I thought since we're talking about transparency and privacy policies, it makes sense that we bring it to our committee in full disclosure. So let's open this item up for public comment. We do have Mr. Rentschler here from the MTC, and if you would like to share with us your thoughts about the resolution and our process.
Thank you, Supervisor Avalos, and also thank you to your able staff, Jeremy, for working with us. We appreciate the changes you've made in the resolution. I just want to assure everyone that's here is that we take privacy very seriously, both on the Clipper card and on Fast Track that we also operate at the Commission. And your attention to it kind of keeps us honest, too. We're not perfect. We need to review these things. You have a lot of good suggestions that we're certainly going to take under consideration. One specific outcome of your interest in this subject is the Commission is expected to get some recommendations from us with respect to how long we keep information on closed accounts. It was set many years ago, probably on business and financial reasons, not really thinking about the privacy part. So we're certainly going to bring that back to the Commission as a direct result of your interest in this subject. And you have a lot of other good suggestions here as well. I can answer specific questions about why Clipper works the way it does with respect to the information we keep on the card, the transactions, which mostly have to do with the fact that we want to give people the discounts that they're due as a result of the policies of the different transit districts and transfers and so forth and so on. So in any event, I just want to thank you and your staff for working with us on this resolution.
Thank you. I appreciate your work working with Jeremy Pollock in my office and your time on this. I guess I have one, big question, and that is I have like three Clipper cards myself. I purchased them with a commuter benefit check from Walgreens. I don't know if anyone really knows that they actually belong to me. I also have a commuter benefit Visa card that I'm able to purchase Clipper cards at vendor sites in the BART stations. And I'm not sure there's actually, besides linking that Clipper card to my Visa card that is a commuter benefit Visa card, whether there's actual understanding that I am the owner of that Clipper card. Mm-hmm. And so how many people actually is the program able to identify a particular card with a particular person?
Mm-hmm. So this is a Clipper card here. The information on this card is essentially the serial number of the card, and it has your last 10 transactions on it. So if you used it to ride BART or used it to ride Muni, the last 10 are on there in order to calculate your discounts if you need them. Other than that, there's no other information on the card other than, again, the loading in the past. So if you've put $10 on it or put a fare on it, it has that. But your personal information is separate and is at a customer service center that is far away and not linked to your card. No one can get anything from your card, even if these devices which are being introduced scan it. Your information resides in that customer service center in case you call and say, hey, I went to Walgreens and the Walgreens person put the wrong thing on my card. As you can see, I regularly get a Muni pass, but they put this on it instead. Can you change that? And we do so. So the customer service, which is privately contracted out, is really the only place where a connection is made to you as a person, and almost it only as a result of your request.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
If there are no other comments or questions, we'll go on to public comment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rentschler. Any member of the public who would like to comment, please come forward.
Oh, So, thank you, Supervisor Valdo, members of the board. My name is Chris Connolly. I'm an attorney and technologist with the ACLU of Northern California. Part of our mission is to ensure that as new technologies, such as our wonderful Clipper cards, come along, that people don't have to choose between using this technology to enhance their lives and keeping control of their own personal information. So we are very encouraged to hear that the MTC is looking at this issue and is planning on revamping its privacy policy to respect the issue of consumer information that is collected through its services. Because Clipper information, although it is not as precise as information from a cell phone, can reveal quite a bit about an individual. It can reveal whether you got on or off BART near a Occupy protest, near a hospital, near a rally, near a clinic, near all sorts of things that may imply things about your personal life. And particularly over a long period of time, there is an extensive amount of information collected about a person, their habits, what they do on Saturday or Sunday, are they going to church regularly or not? Are they showing up at baseball games when they're supposed to be at work? There's an immense amount of information in location that even something as fairly coarse as Clipper card records can compel and can provide about an individual. So I think it is important to recognize that these records should be respected, should be treated as private information, and as the Commission said, should be looked at and retained only as long as necessary for operational purposes, not because it's cheap to retain data, but because you need them for fraud prevention, for transit discounts, or whatever it may be. So I think that's a very important piece of this resolution, and I encourage that. The second thing I'd like to do is actually demonstrate to the committee, if you haven't seen this, the Farebot application. So this is the application for an Android smartphone that can read a Clipper card.
What is it? What is the app called again?
The app is called Farebot, F-A-R-E-B-O-T. It's publicly available on the Android store. It's free. It requires a new Android phone that has what's called NFC, or near-field communication. This is a variety of radio that allows it to read signals from a device.
Please continue. Your time is up, and we'll allow you to demonstrate
the
application.
So the way that this works, is this a good place to put this? Or great. So all you need to do with the app is start an app, touch it to a card. Doesn't like being directly on that. It will read the card, and it will tell you the balance available on the card. Recent trips, I believe it's actually 15 recent transactions rather than 10, if you count these up. And it is no time limit, so it may be 15 in the last week or 15 in the last number of months or even years, potentially. When the card has been refilled, and it also records information about the identity, the serial number of the card, and a few other technical details. So this can reveal a little bit of information about a person in a single read, but notably, it can be used repeatedly. And because it reads the serial number, you can actually record the same person and see if it's the same card. So you could use this very simply on a smartphone to track your partner or your child or your parent or anyone whose card you have direct access to on a regular basis. You can actually obtain information about their comings and goings. Technologically, it's possible to build a better reader than what's on a smartphone to read these cards from a greater distance. Exactly what that distance is, I'm not sure, but it certainly would not require contact with cards under a stronger radio technology to receive signals and send signals to the card. So this is something that I hope the Commission will address in terms of looking at the information that's stored on these cards, the fact that it's not encrypted in any way so that anyone with a phone can read not only their own Clipper card, but anyone's Clipper card, and finding ways to make sure that information is secure. And then finally, I'd like to actually just endorse what you've added to this, which is the transparency provision here, to require the MTC to actually report every year on how many requests it receives for information and how it handles those requests. Because as we know, there is a great deal of interest from many parties, law enforcement, civil litigants, and others, in location information and other information about individuals. And we need to have transparency around how often this information is being shared in order to have an informed dialogue with you, with the Commission, with our public and our legislators about how to handle this private information and encouraging transparency about when and if this information is demanded and whether those demands are complied with is really essential. So I thank you for that.
Thank you very much. I think that's actually the strongest part of the resolution, so appreciate it. Supervisor Moore.
Yeah,
any other member of the public who'd like to comment?
Actually, I was just going to thank the ACLU for raising awareness about the privacy concerns. I definitely am surprised at how much information from an app you can hear from these cards. And Supervisor Navalos and I were just chatting a little bit. My 12-year-old uses her Clipper card often, and I'm very curious if she's going to places that she says she is as a 12-year-old, but that will be useful for me as a parent to find maybe an iPhone app for that. But I also understand the privacy concerns, especially within the MTA, to be more transparent. So I'm really appreciative of the legislation, and I'd just like to ask if I could be added as a co-sponsor as well.
Great. Just important to say that the resolution references that it's really BART and the material that BART's able to put on the Clipper card that actually does the tracking, but within the MTA, you really can't track where someone's been within the MTA system of San Francisco. So that might not help you with your daughter. Okay, we'll close public comment. And we actually have a member of the whole. We can actually take that, colleagues. I don't have a copy. Erica, you have a copy of that? So we could take that, colleagues, without objection, member of the whole, okay? And we can send the item forward with recommendation? Okay. Good. Let's call our next item, please.
Item number 2, hearing to receive a briefing on San Francisco's public safety conditions from the San Francisco Police Department and Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice.
Great. Thank you, Madam Clerk. We haven't had an update in a number of months from our departments, public safety departments, about how we are doing as a city in terms of responding to crime in our city. So we have Jason Elliott, who's here to start off the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jason Elliott from the Mayor's Office. I'll be very brief. Thank you for calling this hearing and continuing pay attention to this issue. It's a topic of constant conversation and meetings in the mayor's office. What we're going to present to you today is a condensed version in the interest of time, an overview of the mayor's new IPO, Interrupt, Predict, and Organize, a strategy to fight crime. This is a strategy that was developed and implemented beginning in July. It's now November, so we have really begun to see fruits of that labor. So we'll provide a brief update there. And then Commander Murphy from SFPD will respond to the other part of the hearing request, which is for actual crime trends and hard data. So without further ado, and now that I'm thoroughly terrified of what my Clipper card information is contained on there, let me turn it over to the Mayor's Director of Public Safety, Paul Henderson.
Okay, Mr. Henderson, welcome.
Good morning, Supervisors. Good to see you all again. So with that introduction, we have a little slideshow here with the information that I don't know if you guys can capture that as well. And basically, here is our strategy, and all of these things are kind of interrelated. So they all fold into each other, but it's interrupt, predict, and organize are basically how we've structured what this new approach is. And that's kind of the innovative aspect of it. And basically, it's broken down like this. The interrupt part is interrupting the violence through enforcement. The predictive component is predictive policing for more effective violence prevention strategy, and the organizing, which is social service agencies, enforcement agencies, nonprofit organizations, faith-based organizations, business-to-work collaborative, kind of the things that you see in the community and on the streets. And so it's kind of a new partnership that we built, and that's the innovative component that we've put into the strategy. I'm going to just talk a little bit about, it's both myself and Deanna. Deanna's going to get up in a moment, and the police department is going to get up in a moment. I focus really primarily on the I and the P, which is the interrupt and the predict. So I just want to give an overview of what that is and how it works so you have a better understanding of what we're doing. So the interrupt part, which is also an introduction of the new zone strategy within the police department, includes the following. Does this roll up or does it just stop here? You guys see, you guys have it in front of you, the full thing. Okay. So it's the violence response teams, the VRTs. It includes gang suppression efforts, the ceasefire meetings, fugitive recovery enforcement, all of our gun abatement programs collectively, and our youth and family programs, which also dovetails into the organizing component. Now, a lot of these things may look familiar to you because some of them are existing resources that were already in place. The innovative component or the innovative approach is figuring out what the best practices were and making sure that they are all interlinked in new ways of both accountability and in communication, from starting at the top, from a senior level with the chiefs and the department heads, making sure that this information is shared. And I think just to put a framework on it, or so it's in context for all of you, you know, some of the new things that we're dealing with are the PRCS results that have come out as a result from realignment, because that's added a whole nother layer in terms of what public safety looks like and how the departments are responding.
Could you spell out, or actually...
PRCS?
PRCS, yeah.
Sure. That's the post-release community supervision. I just wrote it down because I just use it all the time, and I just wrote down anticipating that question.
And that's related to
This is related to the movement within government to release people from the state prison system back into local authority. And so what that has caused throughout the entire state is that there's a new classification of individuals that are being released from custody to specific jurisdictions. And in San Francisco, you know, we've really taken the lead in terms of being prepared for that community coming back here, and it's folded into the IPO. And part of the reason why we have an IPO is to address that concerns, because it is something new that all counties have to deal with in different ways. So I just wanted to put it in context of how we got here and what it means and how it works, kind of from the top as an umbrella policy of all of this is under IPO, but this is kind of how we got here and what we're dealing with. So that's the interrupting component. From a predictive component, are the P in the IPO. And really what we do here, and the police are going to speak to this and give you a little more detail, because I think you guys want more of an overview of actually how it works. But generally the approach with the predictive is using the technology that we have with real-time crime analysis. And I think everyone here is already somewhat familiar with ComStat and what we've done in the past and how information was collected in the past. But now what we're doing is using the information that we collect from ComStat in real time to make sure that assets and resources are deployed in neighborhoods and in areas in real time when there's a crisis to be addressed or problems that come up. We can deploy resources based on the research that we're collecting. The other thing that we're looking at right now are software in terms of best practices throughout the country, software that actually does some of the police predicting as well. And it's listed there, some of the cities that we've seen those in place. That we're contemplating adding to the police department here in San Francisco. But before we even get there, we've already deployed, Murphy is going to speak to this now when I sit down, but he's already working on doing the real-time deployment and doing the analysis of the predictive policing itself. So,
what would I be interested in hearing, because it seems that you have IPO, interrupt, predict, organize. Mm-hmm. It seems like those are things that typically we do as a city already. So what is actually new, and how can you explain a new modality in terms of policing that has really come into effect with IPO?
Right. So while some of these things may have existed in the past, what we've done is evaluate which things were working best and which things need to be brought to the table and enhanced. And one of the big enhancements, or one of the innovations that we've introduced about some of the old tools, is how we share those resources and communicate back and forth with each other. So even though adult probation dealt with probationers, and even though San Francisco Police Department was dealing with people on the street, having them at the same table at regular meetings discussing specific issues of concern as they come up, like the, as I was explaining before with the realignment stuff, you know, these are fairly new things that have to be discussed and have to be prepared and have to be integrated in the communication so that it's not just the law enforcement agencies working in silos, addressing their own jurisdictions. There aren't really real jurisdictions in law enforcement. They have to be sharing information collectively and that's from the top to the bottom. And, you know, just in specifically talking about the IPO, I think what's new and I think is more helpful than not is the focus with the organizing and the community component. So it's not just the community dealing and reacting to public safety, it's the community sharing information with and through law enforcement so that they are part of the discussion and really partners in how the city approaches what public safety is. I mean, am I answering the question?
Yeah, yes, and if you could explain how you've been able to implement an IPO strategy within, say, Visitation Valley or Bayview Hunters Point. Like, how has this new strategy resulted in real communication and collaboration, and what are the examples of the organizations and the departments and how they work together?
So a lot of the stuff, and I don't want to steal Deanna's thunder, on the organization level is the stuff where you see, like, literally on the streets where you're talking about specific neighborhoods and specific districts. But from the I and the O perspective, how it works is that information as it goes up, what's happening is we have regular meetings from these agencies that are dealing with that information when it comes in from the streets. So it's not just, oh, we may have had an incident that happened last week, for example. It's what happens as a result of, let's say there's a shooting in whatever neighborhood. So as a result of that shooting, information comes. The situation doesn't end because someone was arrested. The situation doesn't end right there because, as you know, individuals are still dealing with that trauma. The neighborhood is still affected. You need to figure out what the root causes are from that shooting. And so one of the things that's happening now is that neighborhoods are meeting and communities are coming together to discuss those incidents. And then they're also sharing that information with law enforcement so it goes back up into the ranks so that they can accommodate more quickly how to respond to not just to make sure that someone got shot and now they're being held accountable and that person may go to jail or be in prison, but that we are integrating law enforcement to make sure that we don't have that same kind of shooting in the future. Or if this is something that law enforcement can insert itself in to make sure that we don't have related shootings occurring as a result of that first shooting. Is that making sense? Some of these things were happening before, but they weren't happening at the level that they're happening now, where we're having such shared communication that it's flowing back and forth from top to bottom, so that the meetings that are taking place in the community, that information is being shared all the way up to the top in the law enforcement agencies, and then they are adapting and developing policies to address those situations.
Thank you.
But if you have specific stuff, I know when we get to the organizing part, we're going to go into flesh it out as to what that looks like on the street on a daily basis and what it looks like in the specific neighborhoods. So,
this is really helpful to get the bigger overview. And then you just gave an example of if there's some activity in a neighborhood, crime activity, that you can then kind of focus more on preventative strategies to prevent it for the future. So there were, I think, 4 armed robberies in the Richmond district in August. I know that we were working closely with the police captain in our district, but knowing more of how there's a citywide approach to creating a merchant watch area or some concentrated crime prevention strategy, that would be really helpful for me to know.
So, with that example specifically, so there were already agencies that existed that did, you know, like SF Safe, that would organize merchants and they would come in. But having SF Safe be activated by specific incidents that have happened, those are some of the new approaches and those are some of the innovative practices that we've incorporated now so that it's more than just a happenstance occurrence that a community-based organization that has a role to play will play it. It's that we're all talking and communicating and sharing information now so that when there's an incident, it's not just, okay, there was that robbery and there are 4 separate robberies, because they're not 4 separate robberies. They're all interrelated or they're all linked, even if that link is just that they're happening in the same place, because what that means and what that says to law enforcement is that this community can be taking steps to make sure that as we had those 4, there's not going to be 5.
And then I'm really pleased that even though 3 suspects were apprehended, that it doesn't stop there,
correct,
that there's ongoing community-based efforts. So this is, I'm really glad to hear this, and the big overview to the how it works in our neighborhoods.
Well, that's exactly the point. Like, it's really the umbrella. IPO is the umbrella, and all of these things fall under the umbrella, but it's not just at the bottom. It goes all the way back up to the top, and that there are scheduled meetings to make sure that the chiefs and the department heads of all of those law enforcement agencies are getting information and feedback from what's happening in the specific neighborhoods. And then it folds into, like, the predictive policing to make sure that resources are there and that the information is shared. Again, like I said, I think it's really important that we stress that the information flows back and forward from the top to the bottom, so that the information that the of what law enforcement is doing is being shared on the streets, so that people can share resources and accommodate how they can partner with law enforcement, and things are happening with the community, not to the community. With that, let me introduce the organization, because I think that folds into what's happening in the districts and the neighbors, unless there are more questions. No? Great. Thank you. Deanna?
Great. So I would say that one of the more newer sections of really moving forward in a different approach around violence prevention.
I'm sorry, if you just want to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Deanna Oliva Arroche. I'm the Mayor Lee's new Director of Violence Prevention Services. Good morning, Supervisors, Supervisor Avalos, Alaki, and Mar. Thank you for having us here. So for the organized, I'll just pick up where Paul left off. In terms of the organized section, for it really emphasizes the importance of making sure that there's a bridge between social service agencies and enforcement agencies, that there's an ongoing dialogue, as Paul mentioned, around trying to create a strategy that really is effective, not only in targeting the individuals that are high at risk and in risk in custody, but also targeting families and targeting the faith-based community, using our strength as a community in general to be able to mobilize and really organize communities to promote a stop to violence. So I would say that this is one of the newer approaches that, you know, throughout my time in the last 15 years that I've been doing violence prevention, I've never seen a component that really emphasizes the organizing piece that includes all the community residents, that really pushes to get out to the community and function at the ground level. So a little bit more about that. In terms of the organize, again, it relates to a strategy. It emphasizes implementing a coordinated enforcement and social service strategy. We also really are looking into trying to create wraparound programs that really address behavioral needs, early intervention needs, workforce needs, and in general, educational needs, which are very much prime indicators of why many individuals end up actually engaging in violence. And so we want to get to those factors, right, that really inhibit someone from progressing in life in general, and it's and at the same time, we want to be able to build successful wraparound programs. So those are the major pieces of the O section. Another huge area that is very new in some of our violence prevention approaches to the city and county is an education and community mobilization section, right, an objective that really relates to trying to create or trying to really rely on our strength in the community residents, whether it be faith-based groups, individuals that are just passionate about stopping violence, really working with them to create community gatherings and to create, in general, plans so that they could go ahead as a community, give us input as the mayor's office on what needs to get done to really stop the violence in general. So that's the organized section as a whole. The IPO, you know, you'll see it divided into the sections that Paul discussed, which relate to interrupt, predict, and organize. As I mentioned earlier, there are specific objectives that relate to each section that really emphasize just trying to bring the umbrella together to create a safer San Francisco. So this is just a draft template because we're still creating a lot of we're having an opportunity where we're allowing input to come in for the next couple of months to really solidify this chart. We're working really closely with city agencies trying to reflect, you know, do we need to shift anything? Do we need more input? We're trying to go out to the community, work really closely with our faith-based constituents to really make sure that we're capturing all the needs in each area. One of the areas that have been activated, and Supervisor Avalos, you were one of the first supervisors that engaged in this setting in the street violence response team, is exactly that, the street violence response team. It's a new approach, and it really tries to emphasize trying to coordinate an overall strategy whenever there's a homicide or a critical assault that's impacting a community. So as Paul discussed, you know, this is an opportunity where the purpose is to really focus on an actual critical incident that has happened and it has really impacted San Francisco as a whole, right? Homicides impact all families, children, youth, and families throughout the city and county. And so the mayor's office really felt that it was important to begin organizing a critical response team that would basically create a table of captains from the station, the CBOs that are doing the work on the ground level, the SFCRN that is doing the street outreach, if an and they're involved depending on the incident, DPH's critical response team, critical crisis response services, and the DA victim witness program, and SFUSD if it relates to individuals that are in the SFUSD structure. So how do we activate this SVRT? The way that we activate it is, so once again, SFPD provides the information to our unit in 24 hours whenever there's a homicide or critical assault. Then following that, what I do is then I assess and determine whether a meeting needs to take place in 2 days or whether we can go ahead and have the discussion in our weekly session. So for homicides, we will be responding in 2 days just because of the critical matter, and we want to make sure that families and children and youth and anyone that's impacted receive services in a coordinated fashion. For critical assaults, we'll actually be having a weekly meeting from 2:30 to 3:30 every Tuesday to be able to review what are those critical stabbings, how is it impacting the individual, how is it impacting family members, and how is it impacting community. In terms of a follow-up, our role, and I have a team that's going to be working with us to try to actually make sure that there's a response, that there's a traction, and there's a tracking mechanism where we make sure that everyone that has committed to resources, that they follow up immediately, and that the families or anyone that's impacted really receives a whole full breath of a service plan, right? So this is a very new and innovative approach. We've never done it in this fashion. And then in terms of confidential pieces.
Just to, if I might stop you for a second. Are you personally in direct relationship with any of the victims' families, or you're aware of, all the different families that are impacted by homicide?
We are aware of
You personally? I'm just trying to figure out the chain of command on that.
Jasmine Dawson is the point of contact in our office. Depending on, our relationships, if I happen to know the family because of my previous work, of course we try to intervene and work closely with that family. However, Jasmine Dawson and then our service providers are the most appropriate point of contact to really work closely with the family, just given some of the confidential pieces that relate to some of the cases. And so we're actually encouraging that we keep these meetings just overarching, in terms of the planning piece for San Francisco, but then all the confidential one-on-one contact, that it really happened independent from this setting, because it needs to, it needs to obey by confidentiality agreements. So I would say that the service providers are the ones that really know the families in depth, and they're invited to our meetings to be able to just give us information in general in a confidential way, but then also to be able to really link up to the rest of the constituents that are there. So following that, in terms of outcome, we are going to be tracking outcomes. And then one big piece that's part of these meetings is organizing community events that really respond to some of the issues that are going on. Currently, right now, with the 6 incidences that we've responded to, these are some of the outcomes that we have so far. These are the areas that were impacted in October through November up to date. Since I've been appointed to this position, we've started these meetings, and these are the homicides that have impacted San Francisco. We've responded to all of them in terms of the enforcement strategy. The VRT teams have been able to be deployed and actually available to be able to offer more enforcement in certain communities that need more patrolling, more beat officers. That's part of our discussion as well, because it's a full breath plan of trying to really prevent street violence.
Do you have a hard copy of this?
I do.
That copies for the committee or?
I don't have any available, but I can email them to you.
It's just kind of hard to read on the screen.
Okay. So, we can provide some copies. And then in terms of the individual, again, like I mentioned earlier, San Francisco's General Hospital's wraparound project is very instrumental. They're a case management program that's at the bedside when an individual actually is critically wounded. And so they are a part of that prevention team that really tries to make sure that they understand the needs of the individual and then really work closely with any family members. Like I mentioned earlier, DPH is also a big part of that. And all individuals that have been impacted by all of these homicides have been given an opportunity to enroll in behavioral health services through DPH. And then, again, the District Attorney's Office Victim Services is also part of our team, as well as the SFCRN. The DA really works with those victims that need any type of victim services specifically, you know, whether they want to relocate or they need any type of assistance in general. And then the CRN works with the individuals impacted by street violence. They really try to target now deliberately anyone that is part of a homicide that might be gang involved, or if there's further retaliation, now they're at the table really dialoguing with SFPD, DPH, and all the CBOs to really figure out how they can actually de-escalate some of the violence. And so there's a lot of interchanging in terms of information, of course, in a confidential way, but you know, there's definitely a more structured way to actually share information. And then I just want to pause real quick and just emphasize that for the family piece, you know, I would say that family, we're really focusing on families as part of our treatment plans now, because most often it's those mothers, it's those girls, it's the grandmothers, it's the girlfriends that really try to work closely with us and that actually contact the CBOs or our offices, right, to be able to really make sure that their, you know, brother, sister, boyfriend, husband, that they actually get the wraparound services that they need. And what we find is that, you know, throughout all the scenes, all the scenarios that we've had, you know, the women that are part of these communities have been very vocal and have been one of those that really mobilize and organize their constituencies and the voices, right, of trying to promote peace. Not to shine down on our male counterparts and our, you know, that voice, but I just want to emphasize that, you know, for what we've done so far, we've seen a lot of women just really stepping up and being a part of that kind of overall strategy and vision.
There's been, we had a homicide on Mount Vernon in July, and I'm not sure, I haven't had a chance to reach out to the or connect with the family yet, but they actually, the mother of a lost her son has been holding vigils once a month on the date of the event, every month since July. And yeah, it's true that mothers are playing a large role. There's an organization called the Healing Circle, which consists of men and women, but the leadership, a lot of leadership is women who are part of it. And I, you know, it's really important work that yeah. women are doing in there, and men are part of that too, but go ahead, you can continue.
Thank you. And so the last component, like I mentioned earlier, is the community piece, the community section of organizing events. So, you know, we're actually supporting the OMI peace event this afternoon. We're encouraging all the other different peace events that happen in other communities. We're encouraging that type of organization in different impacted areas. We're working with the Bayview possibly to create some type of street fair sometime in January to really promote a message around trying to decrease violence and to offer resources. And so this again is a new component in terms of a violence prevention approach. It's really about trying to break down all the individual service needs, really making sure that we wrap around families, and then that we look forward and try to create as much community input, and that we create a dialogue where it's up and down, top and bottom, that there is no disconnect. So hopefully in the future, you know, we'll strive to definitely creating a better response to violence, a more coordinated response. Our hope is that we can have some legitimate outcomes where we continue decreasing some of the homicide rates through these attempts, and then in general just decreasing violence. Okay. So I'll turn it over to Commander.
Thank you. Before the commander comes up, you did mention tonight we are having a community meeting at the OMI Rec Center, Mini Levy Ward Rec Center at 6 o'clock tonight. That's on the corner of Montana and Plymouth, and that'll be one of those community gatherings that we've had. In the OMI, we've had a large number of homicides compared to other years. We shouldn't have any at all, and it's a chance for community members to talk about what we're seeing needs to be done in investments in the neighborhood and how we can get more residents to work together. So there has been a lot of great organizing that's coming together in the community. And I think that, you know, collaboration, that strategy of working together with the police department and other public safety departments and community-based organizations is really important. I think one thing that needs to be emphasized when we talk about the organizing aspect of the violence prevention work is really looking at the assets and what we need to build on in order to strengthen the efforts around, you mentioned wraparound projects, workforce development, education. I think those, you know, the lack of those things is one of the root causes of violence. And I think looking at not just getting people to work together, but how we can make greater investments in these places so we can actually have more opportunity for people to find is it case management services or to find healthcare services or to get jobs or to get, you know, greater academic support in their lives. We're able to actually really impact more people that way. We know we're going to be laying the groundwork for real prevention that could actually stop us from happening in the future. So that's where I think, you know, it'd be great if we're able to emphasize that more in future budget years. We have the Children's Fund is getting reauthorized, but also there'll be another grant cycle for the Children's Fund coming up that needs to really address these issues as well, especially in neighborhoods that have a higher incidence of violence. And so I just want to put that out there. That's an important direction to continue to go, that we have to increase the investments that we make and not just, you know, make sure that people are working together, but, you know, when they work together, they identify what the needs are and how we can respond as a city. And if we can work together to make sure that we're responding to that need, then I think we're making some progress that'll actually play out for prevention moving forward.
Yes, and I just would like to add that for the mayor's office, currently what we're doing is we're really working closely with the budget office to be able to identify the resources that are needed according to those three layers that I just mentioned earlier. So we are deliberately looking around what type of investment, what type of targeted investment needs to be done in order to make sure that this plan is successful. And we're really trying to make sure that it's in a design or in a program that really ends up reaching the individuals that are mostly impacted, whether they're victims or perpetrators of street violence.
Thank you. And lastly, you know, jobs are really critical for a part of the population that is impacted greatly by violence. And up till this year, there has not been any direct investments of Office of Economic and Workforce Development, workforce training and workforce placement dollars in District 11. And that was something that my office was able to get into the budget this year for the very first time. And I think we need to look at where there is limited investment elsewhere in the city, including continuing to make greater investments in District 11 so we can actually make that impact. We're seeing a huge increase with our economy growing of public dollars. You know, I think it's important that we look at how we can use them and target in specific neighborhoods where we're seeing this high incidence of violence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Supervisors. I'm John Murphy. I'm the Commander of Investigations for the San Francisco Police Department. Without repeating what my learned colleagues have already talked about, I just want to say that the overarching goal that Chief Sir has mandated is that no more fragmentation of responsibility for anyone, that we as a city family, all the different agencies, have to share information and work together in order to solve the violence in our communities, because public safety is all of our responsibility. So without repeating what's already been said, I just want to talk about, you're asking about the more new and innovative things that we're doing. We brought back many of the tried and true enforcement operations, such as doing parole searches, probation searches. But what we're doing now is we're including other agencies, juvenile probation, adult probation, the Sheriff's Department. And how it's different is this. An individual might be on probation, he might be on parole, might be on juvenile probation, or it might be a PRCS release. Well, they may not be in an area, they may be in an area which is a violation of their probation, but it may not necessarily be a crime. So by partnering with JDP, juvenile adult probation, we're able to identify people who are violating their probation, and then the probation department can take action to that end. We also, the Assembly Bill 109 has created a situation where we need to address what's happening with the PRCS, the post-release community supervision individuals. And what we've done is we're really focusing on the individuals who have been released from state prison that are on PRCS that are arrested in possession of firearms. When they're arrested in possession of firearms, or if they're a victim of a crime, I get a copy of the report, I get a, and I meet with, either meet with Wendy Still or Marty from adult probation, and actually bring them a copy of the report and say, hey, you know, this individual, they were, not only are they on PRCS release and they got arrested in San Francisco, but they got arrested in Oakland, they got arrested in Richmond, they may have gotten arrested in San Mateo. So to that end, it's all of our responsibilities that the person might be a PRCS release out of San Mateo being released here. So then when Wendy Still will do is make sure that gets that information gets to the San Mateo County Probation Department that who's in charge of the PCRS there, and that we work together almost as a region as opposed to just San Francisco. So there is no more fragmentation of responsibility. The other new thing that we came up with is an actual calendar. You're familiar with the zone enforcement, but now we have an actual calendar for Thursday through Sunday. And what it does is I personally do the calendar, and I include the specialized units like the Hondas, the Solos, the tactical units, day watch and night watch, and the violence reduction teams and gang task force. And the calendar, literally, I divide the city into the zones, and I assign people to those areas, both days and nights. And the supervisor that's on scene, who's in charge of each of those groups, we have their cell phone number right on the calendar. So when something happens, or if they need information from me, I can immediately send it to them. For instance, violence in the Mission. Well, what had happened is many of the officers from TAC, they have a general idea of the locations of where the gang areas are. So when a gang incident occurred, I was able simply to print out and send them the maps of the area and have the tactical units, which are uniformed officers, do high-profile patrol. Also, send the VRT teams, immediately get on the phone. I want one squad here, 24th Street, one squad on 16th Street. You guys, you got to stay there. You got to be very vigilant. Let's see if this incident is going to escalate. And while that's going on, we find out whether it is even a gang-related incident. Because we've had community-based organization members who have called me and basically said, hey, the one that happened at 3rd and Palou, it's not a gang thing. That was a personal beef. You don't need to worry about it. So I think that it's working, that the community-based organization members are trusting us and reaching out to us to tell us what's going on. Then as far as technology, we've really ramped up our involvement with our technology in that we've created a database for people that have been arrested for robberies, people that have been arrested for guns, and then we find out exactly, you know, where these robberies occurred, and then with that information, the items that were taken, we're looking into a private database called Leads Online, and we see if that individual has been pawning stolen property off prior, so that we're able to close those cases also and maybe solve prior violent crimes. To that end, we've had Lieutenant Plyer to organize all of the station SIT teams, and that the SIT teams are the station investigative teams, where each station now has a standalone computer and a 55-inch screen where the crime alerts are streaming through. So the officers are seeing what's going on in the city, who's wanted for what, whether they're known or unknown. So it's really increased their awareness. And then through that information sharing with the officers, we're identifying individuals that have committed robberies or are unidentified and or are involved in a series of robberies. The VRT team that we've talked about, that's the violence reduction teams. The violence reduction team has about 45 people in it. So it's very effective to put them into the different zones under direct supervision. And included in that is we reached out with a new program called the Gun Stop Program. And a Gun Stop Program basically is people can anonymously notify, call the police through the Department of, or through 553-1071. They call the DOC and say that I know somebody who has a gun. I don't have to, they don't have to give their name. They don't have to say anything. They give us, they identify an individual. And if an arrest is made, that individual can get a reward for turning that individual in and, or the gun in. And it's all done through through a private bank. And the rewards vary, but it's very effective. And so far we've done real well anonymously seizing guns off people.
Could you say how many?
I think we're at about 8.
Over the last how?
I'd have to look. Probably this more than 8 this year. But what it does is it allows, you got to remember that some of these people that the individuals are calling on, they're very violent people, and they're afraid of them. So when they call, when they're calling us, that's a key to us to say, wait a minute, if this person that knows this person is calling the police on this person, that this must be a very serious issue. But it has worked where we've gotten, I believe, at least one AK-47, several semi-automatic handguns off of people, without talking about specifics that were just absolute key. And then our meetings, we have meetings, standing meetings regarding ceasefire. Ceasefire is, we've had ceasefire for several years, but we tweaked it a little bit. And when I talked about the Sheriff's Department earlier, what the ceasefire meeting brings together not only law enforcement, but adult probation, juvenile probation, the Sheriff's Department. The Sheriff's Department has a classification unit. That classification unit, they have control over what happens in the jails. So although someone who's arrested on the street may not claim to be a gang member, or they tell their probation officer they're not a gang member, when they go to the jails, if they are a gang member, they do tell the classification unit. And that's one way we're able to, you know, to stop the violence in advance. That's one. And then two, we started streaming all of our crime alerts to the Sheriff's Department. And so who better to know the criminals than the individuals, the sheriffs that watch the individuals and are with them and interact with them while they're doing time for prior crimes. Or we've had an instance where the individual committed a series of crimes, but they were arrested for the final crime, and they're sitting in jail already. So it saves our resources, the police department, looking for this suspect when, in fact, he's already sitting in jail, and the sheriff's department can tell us exactly where he's at. And that's pretty much it, just in an overview of the I and the P part that we've started new. We still are doing, as I said, the probation searches, the parole searches. We're still doing a lot of the meetings, but we kind of tweaked them to make them a little better so that we are all responsible. I brought some statistics for you today. The first slide depicts the homicides of all kinds citywide this year compared to last year. And as you can see, there is a spike in the Bayview, the Ingleside, and in the Southern. The Ingleside case, the unfortunate case on House Street, that resulted in 5 homicides. So it kind of skews the statistic that's there, that there's 14 homicides this year. I know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Do you have a? I can't see. It's our screen is blinking, and I don't have a hard copy. But we've also seen a spike in the Terravel, at least the Lakeview neighborhood, and I'm wondering if that's reflected on there as well.
But the spike in the when you look at the empirical data, the spike on the numbers, actually the Terravel homicides are only up. I don't mean to say only up, but they're up 1.
They're up 1 from last year.
From last year.
For me, the trend actually is something that is, you know, a few years in the making. So that, you know, what was it in 20, 2010, and what was it in 2009, I think we'll see a trend upward that I have been concerned about. But certainly these numbers in the Ingleside, Visitation Valley, and in Bayview are very high and compared to other years. And I know that's a big concern for the department, and the IPO strategy has come from that. And since we started IPO and the summer was very hot, how have we seen, the homicides in terms of the trajectory we were on earlier this year? Is that stay the same, or is that diminished?
Oh, they've gone down. Violent crime overall is down 3% this year, and our shootings are down, our non-fatal shootings are down 15%. I have that in another slide. This is a snapshot in time. Last year we had a total of 50 homicides. We're more than that this year. But I think when you look at the isolated one isolated incident really skewed our statistics for this year. And I just want to say also, no homicide is a justifiable homicide. But just looking at the numbers, and I have numbers for over the years coming up, that you'll see how we're from our 2008 year, where we had 98 homicides, we're still staying well below the average. Okay?
And I guess, I didn't ask the question well enough, but so we had, this summer we had, Visitation Valley was very hot, Lakeview was pretty hot, Bayview Hunters Point really hot. And then it was a summer that the IPO strategy was discussed and was implemented, was launched. Have we seen, what's the trend been like since the IPO strategy has come forward? And
take a look at the screen in front of you right now, the numbers, the homicides by month. We did notice the June and July spike where we had 18 homicides between the 2 months. But when we implemented the IPO plan, you'll see that part of the reason, in the month of August, we had no homicides at all, zero. And we haven't had that when you look to the slide immediately to the right. Historically, that's a 10-year run or 11-year run, actually, from 2002 to 2011. August, we averaged somewhere, around six homicides. So if you look at the trend there, the trend clearly went down. Yes, we did have a spike in June and July, but then you see it's leveling off and even reduced. September and August way down. September and October has leveled off. November, we've had two. So I think it's working. It's going to take us a little more time, just looking at that one snapshot.
Supervisor O'Loughlin, thank you.
I was wondering, how does that compare to shootings? Because I know frequently, there's this emphasis on homicides, but it doesn't really speak to the fact that the violence is still occurring. So, the shootings don't, just because a person doesn't.
You read our mind also.
Okay.
one of the true gauges of violence is, who actually gets shot and survived. So the next slide is our non-fatal shootings without homicides by firearms, just by firearms in the police districts. Okay, this is citywide. And as you can see, the non-fatal shootings with firearms without per individual dying are down 15%.
Wow.
So that's huge. You see the number of last year to date is through Halloween was 152, and now we're down to 129. So that's key to us that, in fact, when you look at those shootings, you're seeing the trend is going down, and it has gone down 2009, 2010, and here we are 2012.
Thank you. It's good to note, and I do appreciate that. It's pretty clear in most police districts, except for Northern. And Northern, we're seeing a trend upward.
Yes, we are.
It's just important to note.
It is important to note, and in that light, we've created a database that where we can track when a shooting occurs, we note where it takes place. So, for instance, if it took place in the 800 block of Buchanan, well, the next likely place, for a shooting to occur might be on Larch Alley. So that's where we immediately change our strategy and go, okay, if I have the VRT guys south of Market, I'll move them to the Western Addition and say, hey, we can't have a back and forth and back and forth. And we did have a back and forth during the summer where it went from, it looked like it was Eddie Rock, KOP, Mac Block, Central DeViz, looked like, I don't know exactly who was warring with who, but we did have a back and forth, and that accounts for the spike in the numbers. Okay.
My whatever isn't working. But I was wondering, is there, you know, every few years, I think every 10 years, they reevaluate the election district lines. And I'm wondering, will there ever be a reevaluation of the police,
you know, boundaries?
Because there just seems to be a kind of this, what's the word? For instance, Northern Station, you know, they go to the marina and then they have pieces of the Western Addition. There seems to be this kind of like, it doesn't seem to be thematic or, I just wonder what criteria is used to create those boundaries and when was the last time it was evaluated?
I think I've been in for, I've been for 31 and a half years, twice. The most recently was years ago. Like I got to think 20, 25 years ago. At least 20 years ago, I think. But you're right, because the definition of the Western Addition.
Yeah, because the demographics have shifted in the whole city. So to such an extreme that it seems that there might be some, this might be the time to start revisiting that issue.
Well, I see what you're saying, because if you say the Western Addition, shouldn't that include Haight Street? Shouldn't that include,
And NOPA didn't exist,
That's right.
Huh?
NOPA didn't exist.
Didn't exist.
I mean, it just seems that, you know, the whole city has changed. Van Ness has its own set of issues.
Right.
So, I don't know.
My neighborhood, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, and then just the final slide that I have to present to you is it's the homicides by firearm and the non-fatal shootings in the police districts. So these are the people who, the non-fatal shootings, the people that survived, and then the people who were shot and killed. And it's still down, we're still trending down 6%. So I know that those numbers aren't very comforting for sure. We'd like to see them much lower. But I think that our strategy is working. We're all strapped for staffing, but I think we're doing a pretty good job with what we got. I think the calendaring of the personnel in the different areas and our immediate response. Because if the supervisor working that day has any questions, or if I need to talk to somebody directly, at least we can quell what's going on immediately by sending both uniform and plainclothes officers, motorcycle solo officers, the Honda units. We can pre-stage them, and then when an incident occurs, we can post-stage them and leave them in areas where we think it's going to, where it may flame up. Okay, you got any questions?
Do you have that information broken down according to demographics, like or age and race? And
For today? We do for homicides. That's on our website.
Okay, but not for the shooting piece.
The shootings, we do keep that in a database, yes.
Okay.
But I think most of that's on our website,
available on our website.
In the aggregate.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commander Murphy. Appreciate your time. Okay. Colleagues, if there are no other comments or questions, I just want to announce that we are having a community meeting tonight in the OMI neighborhood. I think some of the folks who have presented here will be here there tonight. It'll be community-based organizations, a lot of community leaders, community residents, the probation department, DCYF, DPH, police department. Captain Lum will be there for the Terrebonne Station. It'll be a chance for the neighborhood to come together around the spike we've recently had this year in homicides in the OMI, and to I think a lot of community members will be discussing what they see as some of the strategies that need to be implemented in the neighborhood to help prevent homicides from happening in the future. So that'll be at 6 o'clock tonight at the Minnie and Lovie Ward Rec Center, formerly called the Ocean View Rec Center, on the corner of Plymouth in Montana. I will be there, of course, in my office, and that'll start at 6 o'clock tonight, so I just want to make that announcement. And I think it's part of the effort that we have moving forward about how we can really organize around a response at a neighborhood level for homicides here in our neighborhoods in San Francisco. So this item, we can continue to the call of the chair. Colleagues, who can take that without objection? Okay. And do we have any other items before us?
That completes the agenda.
Then we are adjourned. Thank you. We'll be right back.